Chapter 8. A month of inactivity, a heavy meal, and an unknown world do not help a man to run. Half an hour later, Ransom was walking, not running, through the forest, with a hand pressed to his aching side and his ears strained for any noise of pursuit. The clamour of revolver shots and voices behind him, not all human voices, had been succeeded first by rifle shots and calls at long intervals, and then by utter silence. As far as eye could reach, he saw nothing but the stems of the great plants about him receding in the violet shade, and far overhead the multiple transparency of huge leaves filtering the sunshine to the solemn splendour of twilight in which he walked. Whenever he felt able, he ran again. The ground continued soft and springy, covered with the same resilient weed which was the first thing his hands had touched in Malacandra. Once or twice a small red creature scuttled across his path, but otherwise there seemed to be no life stirring in the wood. Nothing to fear, except the fact of wandering unprovisioned and alone in a forest of unknown vegetation thousands or millions of miles beyond the reach or knowledge of man. But Ransom was thinking of Sorns, for doubtless those were the Sorns, those creatures they had tried to give him to. They were quite unlike the horrors his imagination had conjured up, and for that reason had taken him off his guard. They appealed away from the Wellsian fantasies to an earlier, almost an infantile complex of fears. Giants, ogres, ghosts, skeletons, those were its key words. Spooks on stilts, he said to himself, surrealistic bogeymen with their long faces. At the same time, the disabling panic of the first moments was ebbing away from him. The idea of suicide was now far from his mind. Instead, he was determined to back his luck to the end. He prayed, and he felt his knife. He felt a strange emotion of confidence and affection towards himself. He checked himself on the point of saying, "We'll stick to one another." The ground became worse and interrupted his meditation. He had been going gently upwards for some hours with steeper ground on his right, apparently half scaling, half skirting a hill. His path now began to cross a number of ridges, spurs doubtless of the higher ground on the right. He did not know why he should cross them, but for some reason he did. Possibly a vague memory of earthly geography suggested that the lower ground would open out to bare places between wood and water where Sorns would be more likely to catch him. As he continued crossing ridges and gullies, he was struck with their extreme steepness, but somehow they were not very difficult to cross. He noticed, too, that even the smallest hummocks of earth were of an unearthly shape, too narrow, too pointed at the top, and too small at the base. He remembered that the waves on the blue lakes had displayed a similar oddity, and glancing up at the purple leaves, he saw the same theme of perpendicularity, the same rush to the sky, repeated there. They did not tip over at the ends. Vast as they were, air was sufficient to support them so that the long aisles of the forest all rose to a kind of fan tracery. And the Sorns, likewise, he shuddered as he thought it, they too were madly elongated. He had sufficient science to guess that he must be on a world lighter than Earth, where less strength was needed and nature was set free to follow her skyward impulse on a super-terrestrial scale. This set him wondering where he was. He could not remember whether Venus was larger or smaller than Earth, and he had an idea that she would be hotter than this. Perhaps he was on Mars, perhaps even on the Moon. The latter he at first rejected on the ground that, if it were so, he ought to have seen the Earth in the sky when they landed. But later he remembered having been told that one face of the Moon was always turned away from the Earth. For all he knew, he was wandering on the Moon's outer side. And, irrationally enough, this idea brought about him a bleaker sense of desolation than he had yet felt. Many of the gullies which he crossed now carried streams, blue hissing streams, all hastening to the lower ground on his left. Like the lake, they were warm, and the air was warm above them, so that as he climbed down and up the sides of the gullies, he was continually changing temperatures. It was the contrast, as he crested the farther bank of one such small ravine, which first drew his attention to the growing chilliness of the forest. And as he looked about him, he became certain that the light was failing too. He had not taken night into his calculations. He had no means of guessing what night might be on Malacandra. As he stood gazing into the deepening gloom, a sigh of cold wind crept through the purple stems and set them all a-swaying, revealing once again the startling contrast between their size and their apparent flexibility and lightness. Hunger and weariness, long kept at bay by the mingled fear and wonder of his situation, smote him suddenly. He shivered and forced himself to proceed. The wind increased. The mighty leaves danced and dipped above his head, admitting glimpses of a pale and then a paler sky, and then, discomfortingly, of a sky with one or two stars in it. The wood was no longer silent. His eyes darted hither and thither in search of an approaching enemy, and discovered only how quickly the darkness grew upon him. He welcomed the streams now for their warmth. It was this that first suggested to him a possible protection against the increasing cold. There was really no use in going farther. For all he knew, he might as well be walking towards danger as away from it. All was danger. He was no safer travelling than resting. Beside some stream it might be warm enough to lie. He shuffled on to find another gully, and went so far that he began to think he had got out of the region of them. He had almost determined to turn back when the ground began falling steeply. He slipped, recovered, and found himself on the bank of a torrent. The trees, for as trees he could not help regarding them, did not quite meet overhead, and the water itself seemed to have some faintly phosphorescent quality, so that it was lighter here. The fall from right to left was steep. Guided by some vague picnicker's hankering for a better place, he went a few yards upstream. The valley grew steeper, and he came to a little cataract. He noticed dully that the water seemed to be descending a little too slowly for the incline, but he was too tired to speculate about it. The water was apparently hotter than that of the lake, perhaps nearer its subterranean source of heat. What he really wanted to know was whether he dared drink it. He was very thirsty by now, but it looked very poisonous, very unwatery. He would try not to drink it. Perhaps he was so tired that thirst would let him sleep. He sank on his knees and bathed his hands in the warm torrent. Then he rolled over in a hollow close beside the fall and yawned. The sound of his own voice yawning, the old sound heard in night nurseries, school dormitories, and in so many bedrooms, liberated a flood of self-pity. He drew his knees up and hugged himself. He felt a sort of physical, almost a filial, love for his own body. He put his wristwatch to his ear and found that it had stopped. He wound it. Muttering, half whimpering to himself, he thought of men going to bed on the far distant planet Earth. Men in clubs and liners and hotels, married men and small children who slept with nurses in the room, and warm, tobacco-smelling men tumbled together in forecastles and dugouts. The tendency to talk to himself was irresistible. "We'll look after you, Ransom. We'll stick together, old man." It occurred to him that one of those creatures with snapping jaws might live in the stream. "You're quite right, Ransom," he answered mumblingly. "It's not a safe place to spend the night. We'll just rest a bit till you feel better, then we'll go on again. Not now. Presently."